You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
We were the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Welcome back to episode 12 of the Untaming Podcast. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Dr. Katrina Walsh on the true nutritional value of our foods. We discussed the lack of high-quality research behind UK and US dietary guidelines and what's happened to the diversity of our diets. Next week, we have an interview coming up with Ollie Langridge, a father of five living children and a national climate emergency protester. Today, however, I am talking with Dr. Sarah Buckley. I am an enormous fan of her work on our hormonal blueprint. This is the episode to listen to if you would like to know what you can do prior to and after birth to help minimize the hormonal gap and the subsequent implications. The 59-year-old Dr. Sarah Buckley was born in and grew up in Whangarei, New Zealand, and currently lives in the semi-rural outskirts of Brisbane, Australia with her husband Nicholas. They have four children, Emma, Zoe, Jacob and Maya. Dr. Buckley is a New Zealand-trained GP family physician with qualifications in GP obstetrics and family planning. She is also a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland, where her research is focused on the hormone systems of labour and birth and the impacts of interventions. Sarah's father was an obstetrician and her grandfather was a country GP in New Zealand who used to go out on horseback to look after women in labour in the bush. All four of her children were born at home and Sarah has experienced almost everything that she writes about, including instinctive pregnancy, ecstatic birth, attachment parenting, co-sleeping, long-term breastfeeding. Sarah has enjoyed being pregnant and or breastfeeding for more than 15 years. Lotus birth, raising babies without nappies or diapers, yoga in pregnancy and mothering, and gentle parenting through the teenage years and beyond. In her best-selling book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering, Sarah uses current medical and epidemiological research, plus women's experiences, to demonstrate that what she calls undisturbed birth is almost always healthier and safer than high technology approaches to birth. Last night she had 9 hours of sleep, and for breakfast this morning she had her own homemade muesli with activated nuts, raw cacao, maca powder, probiotics, coconut oil and banana. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I read your book Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering last year during my second pregnancy. Whenever people ask for my favourite birthing resources, I include your book and also books by Ina May Gaskin and Michelle Odent. I came across the three of you in completely separate, unrelated ways, but it's inspiring to find that there is a connection between my three favourite birth advocates. Not only did Ina May write the foreword to your book, but I understand Michelle Odent is a mentor of yours.
Yes, yeah. I've been really inspired by his work about the hormones, and you know, he had the experience of working as an obstetrician, well actually he was a surgeon actually, in a small place in France, and really observing undisturbed birth firsthand, and you know, all of his work has come out of those initial observations. And you know, there's not many obstetricians or doctors around that really have ever seen a truly undisturbed birth. So, you know, he's been a great inspiration and mentor to me, and you know, really set me, when I heard his material, you know, when I was pregnant, I mean, really set me on the path of trusting the body, trusting the natural process. He's been a huge contribution to, you know, the natural birth community around the world for decades.
Yeah, brilliant. So then I struggle to understand why the practice of physiological undisturbed birth that all three of you support is not more commonly understood and accepted. I've heard you say that we're waiting for science to catch up to wisdom. Is there a rough time frame there between what science is discovering about, you know, natural physiological birth and that knowledge then becoming implemented into routine practice?
Well, I am optimistic because, you know, I think we can look at what happened with breastfeeding. I mean, you know, in the 60s and 70s, breastfeeding was seen as something kind of animalistic and, you know, and formula was presented to women as safer. And, you know, then we started to get the science and the understanding and the trust of the natural processes of breastfeeding. And I think the parallel things are happening with birth. There's a, you know, a lot of research happening now into physiological childbearing, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts of it, a bit of what I do. But the other really positive thing that's happened, and I think is from my perspective is kind of snowballing, is all the evidence for continuity of midwifery care, which is the number one thing that supports physiological birth. So women having their own midwife who cares for them in pregnancy, labor and birth and postpartum. And, you know, around the world, the evidence-based medicine has become a catch cry, and you know, for policymakers as well. And if we're going to follow evidence-based medicine and maternity care, then we have to promote, we have to make available continuity of midwifery care. And when we do, that generally increases the chances of women having a more of an undisturbed birth, more of a physiological birth. But the other aspect of it is that, you know, we have been disturbing birth for probably centuries, because I was inspired here by the work of Robbie Davis Floyd, who's an anthropologist. And, you know, this anthropological perspective is, well, that birth is intrinsically a rite of passage. You know, the woman goes from being not a mother to a mother, and her baby's born. And, you know, so every culture has a kind of rituals around that rite of passage of motherhood, and the rituals are designed to kind of imprint cultural norms. And we do have cultural norms that say technology is better than nature. We have had that belief, and that what kind of can get imprinted on women in birth, that the machine or the test knows your baby more than you do. So we're battling some kind of cultural norms as well. But you know, every mother can reclaim her body, can reclaim her trust in her body through the processes of labor and birth. So, you know, it is, all those things are happening on the outside, but our bodies still work. That's the thing, because of, you know, we're the result of 65 million years of mammalian evolution. So we're hardwired to be successful in reproduction.
I have heard you say that we don't know what causes labor, and that really labor is 9 months long. With your deep knowledge of the hormone systems, can you share more about the hormones during pregnancy and the effects they have on the mother and the growing baby as they prepare for birth?
Yeah, so yeah, it's exactly as you say. Sometimes I ask people, do you know what causes labor to start? And I say, well, we don't know. And if you did know the answer to that question, you'd get a Nobel Prize, because we don't know the answer. What we can say, what are some of the things that prepare the mother's body, that prepare the baby's body. But the actual thing that triggers the onset of labor in humans, we don't know that for sure, which is kind of ironic when we're so busy bypassing that with induction of labor, with scheduled cesareans, for example. And also, you can also imagine how much research is going into that question so that we could prevent preterm birth. So there's still a bit of a black hole there, you could say. But we know, you know, just from kind of evolutionary principles, you have to say that the readiness of the mother has to be coordinated with the readiness of the baby. Both have to be ready at the same time for birth to be successful. So there's all these pre-labor preparations that happen. And as you say, I sometimes quote a beautiful midwife who's passed over now called Janine Pavati-Baker, and she said, when people ask me how long my labor was, I tell them categorically 9 months. And it's true, really, because the preparations are really beginning way, way back. You know, the baby's getting prepared for life outside the womb from conception, and the mother's body is getting prepared to give birth through, you know, the development of a whole lot of processes that ripen the mother's body, you could say. And these things are happening in parallel. And they happen in parallel, and they're coordinated, as we understand it, through the placenta. So the baby's body, as the baby's body matures, the adrenal gland matures, and it makes more of a hormone called cortisol, which you may be familiar with as a stress hormone. Mm-hmm. But what it actually does for the baby is it matures all the organ systems inside the baby's body, including the lungs. If you've ever had a threatened preterm birth, or if you're a maternity care worker, you may know that we sometimes give artificial forms of cortisol to women in threatened premature labor to help to mature their baby's lungs. But that happens naturally through those pre-labor preparations hormones for the baby. But what happens is as the baby's adrenal is maturing, it's not only producing cortisol, which is helping the baby's body to mature, but it's producing precursors, like chemicals that go into the placenta and then get formed into estrogen, which then goes into the mother's body and helps to mature the mother's body and to prepare it for labor and birth, for successful reproduction. And, you know, in the mother's body, by the way, I'll just go back a step. I wrote a report called Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing in 2015, which is really a very in-depth sort of research-based explanation of everything I'm saying. So if you want to know, you know, the kind of the background to what I'm saying, if you want to see all the studies and everything, then I really recommend you go there and read chapter 2, which is about the physiological onset of labor and the effects of scheduled birth. So that's, I'll get you to put the link in there, Emily.
So
what's happening then is that the mother's body is getting matured, you know, it's getting prepared for labor and birth through rising levels of estrogen, and the baby's body is getting prepared and matured through rising levels of cortisol. Well, that's one system we know, and there's obviously many complex systems, because, you know, this the readiness of the mother and the readiness of the baby and their coordination is absolutely critical for species survival. So there's a lot of what we might call evolutionary investment in the system. So the mother's, so what happens is, you know, in the mother's body throughout pregnancy, it's kind of a balance between the two major female hormones called progesterone, which is progestation. It's the hormone that keeps gestation happening, that keeps, you know, pregnancy going. And then the other is estrogen, which is an activating hormone. So that's the hormone that gets more and more and more in the lead up to labor. And estrogen, this increasing in estrogen that we talked about, does a lot of things to activate the mother's body. But one of the things that it does is it increases, or we say upregulates, the oxytocin system. And we know that oxytocin is a hormone that causes the rhythmic contractions of labor. So estrogen also increases the number of oxytocin receptors, so it makes the mother's body very sensitive to oxytocin, that so that when at, you know, when it kind of tips over, as I said, we don't know exactly what causes this tip over, but when it tips over into physiological onset of labor for the mother, her body is so sensitive that she actually doesn't need to release a lot of her own oxytocin to get labor to start. She's just in this exquisitely sensitive situation for the onset of labor. And we think, you know, that the baby actually triggers the onset of labor in some way. There's lots of theories about that. You know, in some animals, you can actually measure in the bloodstream the progesterone goes down and the estrogen goes up. And that doesn't happen in women. So maybe there's some other metabolites of them that are less active or more active, or, you know, people are kind of, does it happen at the tissue level rather than, and there's lots and lots of theories around that. There's also a substance that the baby's maturing lungs secrete, because obviously the baby's respiratory maturity is critical. The baby has to be able to breathe as soon as it's born. So there's substances that the baby's lungs actually excrete into the amniotic fluid, because in the womb, the lungs are filled with amniotic fluid, and it excretes it into the amniotic fluid, which goes into the uterus and then can actually have a local effect, you know, on the uterus. So that's another mechanism that's been hypothesized as well. As I said, we don't know, but, you know, what we know is, you know, from first principles, that the readiness of the mother and the readiness of the baby are very tightly linked and controlled, because that's what causes reproductive success. And when I do my workshops, I sometimes show a slide of William and Kate, Prince William and Princess Kate getting married at Westminster Cathedral, and I say, you know, the schedule, like making labor happen, you know, induction of labor or scheduled birth, is a bit like William and Kate turning up at Westminster Cathedral, like a week before the scheduled time, or even a day before, or even an hour before. It's just not going to be the same, because all those last minute preparations are just not fully done. So induction of labor intrinsically means that the mother and baby aren't at their peak of readiness, and we don't really know all the consequences of that. You know, we know the mother may have a failed induction because she doesn't have that sensitivity to oxytocin that we talked about. Her system just isn't ready. And, you know, in other animals, like in rats, for example, every rat goes into labor day 21, 22. But women, you know, we have a much wider variation in the normal onset, the physiological onset of labor. So some women go into labor at 37 weeks, some women 42 weeks. So even inducing, you know, there's kind of been a welcome shift to inducing, you know, to not doing these scheduled births until 39 weeks. But some women could still be 2 weeks away from their own physiological onset. And as I said, you know, that the shocking thing really is we don't have a lot of, you know, research on what the long-term implications or even the short-term implications of this are. But for example, we know that in animal studies, in prairie voles, for example, well, animals, you know, the preparations they're talking about are not just about the mother getting through labor and birth successfully and the baby coming out successfully. It's also, there's obviously a big evolutionary investment in long-term survival. And for that long-term survival, the mother needs to successfully lactate, you know, breastfeed in humans. And she also needs to have her maternal behaviors, her attachment system switch on so that she'll give this dedicated care that every mammalian newborn needs. So that's changes that happen in the brain. And all these things are beginning even before the onset of labor. And then there's things that happen in labor, the peaks of oxytocin that switch on all these maternal circuits for other mammals and no doubt women as well. But there's a study they did in prairie voles, which was very interesting. So in a lot of other animals, obviously they don't have the higher brains that we do. And, you know, they operate on brain chemistry and instinct. And, you know, so most other animals will be aggressive to newborn babies, even when they're pregnant. You know, if you present them with a baby, they'll shoo it away or be aggressive towards it. But that changes, you know, there's a change in that, obviously, because they're going to treat their own babies differently. And that change in prairie voles happens just a few hours before the onset of labor. So something's happening in the brain at that time, which switches on the mothering behaviors, the maternal circuits in the brain. And it's very close to the onset of labor. And we, you know, it's not something we've studied in women. We haven't studied really the impacts on breastfeeding and the impacts on attachment and those maternal circuits in women.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. What advice do you have for parents who would like the most hormonally optimal birth?
Yeah, well, from what I've said, the thing would be, you know, allow labor to start on its own, you know, because we just don't know the kind of disruption that we're causing when we cause labor to begin through induction of labor, through scheduled cesarean. So that's the best advice. But obviously, in some situations, it's safer for the mother, sometimes even life-saving for the mother or the baby to have a scheduled birth, to have a pre-labor cesarean. So that, you know, the way that I say that there's all this kind of way that the system designed to work, and what we just talked about, the cortisol and the mother's estrogen and the, you know, oxytocin, all those things coming together for the best chance of success. But when that's not possible, when that doesn't happen, there's a hormonal gap. Yeah, there's a hormonal gap for the baby. The baby doesn't have that cortisol to mature the lungs, especially if it's below 34 weeks or so. And so we give cortisol like drugs to fill in that hormonal gap, right? So the mother doesn't have, you know, there may be, as I say, there may be a hormonal gap for the mother with scheduled birth in relation to the attachment systems for her baby. There may be a hormonal gap for her in relation to just her uterine oxytocin receptors that can't respond because they're not ready, you know. So we, you know, we want to, like, the ideal is obviously to avoid interventions that aren't helpful. But when interventions are needed, you know, we need to be able to fill in those hormonal gaps. And generally, the way to fill in those hormonal gaps is two things, which I call Mother Nature's backup system, is breastfeeding, because breastfeeding releases a lot of these hormones we're talking about. It activates all of the attachment centers in the brain, which are basically the pleasure and reward centers. So just going back a step, you know, that prairie vole and the attachment I was talking about. So what happens in the lead up to labor and birth and other species is we get these changes in the maternal brain that are going to switch on the maternal circuit so that the mother will be basically in a state of high activation of her pleasure and reward centers in her brain when she meets her baby for the first time. So she'll get this best, I say it's like the best first date ever, this very powerful first impression of her baby. You know, her baby will basically in her brain, her baby will get fired, the image of her baby will get fired and wired with her pleasure and reward centers and create a connection so that her baby will be a source of pleasure and reward for her. And that's what's going to motivate her maternal behaviors because it feels good to her. And there's lots of other things that feed into that as well. But basically, that's reward and pleasure center activation happens in humans as well. So, you know, if you get an induction or a pre-labor cesarean, you know, you'd like, we haven't really researched this in a lot of detail, but it's likely that there will be a hormonal gap for you in relation to the pleasure and reward activation you get with your baby. In fact, there was an interesting study that looked at women who'd had a pre-labor cesarean versus women who'd been through a fairly physiological birth and found that the reward and when they listened to the sound of their baby crying, the reward and pleasure centers in women who'd been through a normal birth with the peaks of oxytocin and the pre-labor preparations, you know, their pleasure and reward centers, their alertness centers, even a little bit the anxiety centers switched on. This is my baby, I need to do something about it. But the women who'd been through a pre-labor cesarean didn't have that same activation. So you could see there's a hormonal gap in the brain there. So how do we fill in that hormonal gap? basically, as I said, breastfeeding releases all of these caretaking hormones. It's designed to feel good. It's designed to activate the pleasure and reward centers. It reduces stress. It reduces blood pressure. It reduces cortisol. It produces oxytocin, endorphins, prolactin, all of these chilling out, all these relaxing, pleasurable hormones. And, you know, it switches on those reward and pleasure centers. So, you know, if you miss the active, you know, those hormonal peaks of labor and birth, and you do have this hormonal gap, you know, breastfeeding is the number one way of filling in that. And the other way is skin to skin contact, which also releases oxytocin, switches on pleasure and reward. And in fact, in one study, skin to skin contact regularly for at least 2 hours a day for the first month reduced women's depression scores. And that kind of makes sense because it's designed to feel good. You know, if you think about, I mentioned 65 years of mammalian evolution, you know, that's how long our reproductive system's been evolving for, and 99.9999% of that time's been in the wild, and there's nowhere for the baby to be except on the mother. So there's a whole lot of pleasure and reward that gets built into carrying your baby, especially skin to skin, to encourage mothers to have contact with their babies, because that's what makes their babies safe. You know, for these millions of years of evolution, if you put your baby down and turned around, the baby wouldn't be there. When you turn back again, a predator, a snake, something might have taken it. And if you put your baby in a separate place to sleep, it wouldn't be there in the morning. So there's a whole lot of intrinsic pleasure and reward systems that are activated when we do the kind of caretaking for our babies that has kept us surviving, that has guaranteed reproductive success through these millions of years, including the majority of the time in the wild. So that's a long answer to your question, but hormonal gaps and how to fill them out is basically breastfeeding and carrying your baby, especially skin to skin.
Mm. Okay, what you were just saying there, I just wanted a follow-up question. Is there a certain length of, so say somebody has had to go through an induction or a cesarean for whatever reason, and they're using the breastfeeding and the skin-to-skin. So I think you said 2 hours a day for the first month of skin to skin.
Well, that was a randomized controlled trial that was done. Well, yeah. Basically, we're just going to answer your question in two ways. One is to say that, just going back to evolutionary principles, our babies are designed to be constantly on our skin to skin. So that's the norm. So anything less than that, I'm not saying you don't, you know, no one else can hold your baby, but that's our evolutionary norm. That's why babies will cry when they're not in contact with people, with an adult, because they know that their life is in danger. That's what's been hardwired into their brain. So, you know, that's the norm. But the other thing to say is that I talked about, you know, as estrogen levels go up and then oxytocin system gets activated and it happens more and more, and then it peaks and tips over at the physiological onset of labor. So there's all these preparations that happen that makes the woman's system uber sensitive, so that even a, you know, like an hour and a half labor, you know, half an hour when the baby, you know, like the shortest labor possible, is still going to activate all of those systems for the mother and for the baby. The system is at maximum sensitivity. It's very, very effective, yeah, for that. We'll call it, say, an hour and a half. If you miss that hour and a half, you miss that window of opportunity, and it's going to take a lot more effort to catch up. I'll just share a couple of anecdotes. One is a woman, actually a story I read of a woman who'd had two physiological births, and the third one she had to have a pre-labor cesarean. And she said, when my baby came to me, my baby felt different to my other babies. And it's true, the baby is in a completely different hormonal state, and she's in a different hormonal state as well. And she said, my instinct was to be skin to skin with my baby, and after 3 days of skin to skin, my baby was the same as my other babies. Wow. So that kind of illustrates, like, you know, an hour and a half of labor, no matter how short, is going to activate all those things in this massive, efficient, effective, sensitive way, and it takes a lot more effort to catch up. And there was another study I'll quote, which was actually a study of epidurals, and we can talk about this some more, but you know, epidurals also interfere with the hormone system, and in particular, they reduce oxytocin. When we're talking about oxytocin, it activates the pleasure and reward centers as well as causing the rhythmic contractions of labor. So when women have an epidural, they don't get those same brain changes, at least as far as we can measure in human women, because those brain changes I'm talking about not only switch on the pleasure and reward centers, but they also change women's personality. So we can measure the changes in personality that happen after a physiological birth. Women become more relaxed, more sociable, which is kind of an oxytocin effect. They describe less physical tension in their bodies. So those changes happen after physiological labor and birth. But if you've had an epidural, you don't get those changes. So there's a hormonal gap there in the mother's brain pain from missing out on the peaks of estrogen that don't happen when you have an epidural. But in this study, they actually followed those women up at 6 months, and the women that had exclusively breastfed for that period of time did have the personality changes. So again, you can catch up with breastfeeding, but it takes a long time. You know, every episode of breastfeeding is going to release that, but at that time, you're in a completely different hormonal situation than you were during labor and birth, and you would be in labor and birth. So, you know, there's the hormonal gap, but it takes longer. You've got to take longer. And I can't give you a number because we haven't done that kind of research, you know, the kind of specific research. But basically, the more skin to skin and the more breastfeeding that you have, and also the earlier that happens, because that window of opportunity, as far as we can see, does happen to some extent, even for women having a pre-labor cesarean. So, you know, there are having skin to skin after that seems to be beneficial as well. Immediate skin to skin contact. Yeah, so the earlier the better. That skin to skin, the thing is, the earlier the better. And especially for women having a vaginal birth, you want your baby there as soon as possible. And I don't know, your listeners are probably all around the world, but there's a program called the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative run by the World Health Organization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're going to have one of these interventions, I really recommend that you go to a hospital that's certified as Baby Friendly, BFHI, it's called, Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, because they have agreed that every baby should be with the mother skin to skin as soon as possible after birth, even following a pre-labor cesarean. And you might, you know, if that's necessary for your pre-labor cesarean, I really recommend you go online and look at things like, you know, the natural cesarean, the family-centered cesarean, because people have figured out ways to make it to have as few hormonal gaps as possible. So the baby comes straight onto the mother's chest. There's no separation. Mother and baby are skin to skin. The cords clamp late. Breastfeeding happens as soon as possible, etc. Because, you know, there's a hormonal gap for the baby as well. The baby hasn't had the surge of activating hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline. So the baby's often a bit drowsy and they need a bit of extra help as well. Yeah. So yeah, there's ways of closing that. There's ideal. There's what happens when we have hormonal gaps. And then there's ways of closing the hormonal gaps or addressing the hormonal gaps, but it's going to take more effort and it's going to take longer.
Okay, so with a cesarean, I think, are there three different types you can have? A pre-labor one, a during labor, and then an emergency cesarean? Is that right?
So there are different kinds of cesarean and the terms get a little bit confusing. But basically there's a pre-labor cesarean. So that means that there's some reason we don't want women to go into labor, or there's some, you know, for example, the baby's in a breech position, so it's scheduled, and obviously there's going to be quite a gap there because we don't know when that mother and baby would naturally go into labor. So there could be, it could be a few days or even a few weeks before the physiological onset. So that's kind of the most biggest hormonal gap you can possibly get, is with a pre-labor cesarean. And then there's an in-labor cesarean, and sometimes these are called emergency cesareans, although the majority of them aren't a true emergency. Like something's happening, labor isn't progressing, the mother's getting tired, maybe the baby's not in 100% state but not really at risk. You can get true emergencies, but those are actually very rare, you know, where the mother's life is in danger or the baby's life is in danger. But the other cesarean that I talk about in my report, and just going, you know, sort of which fits in with everything we've been saying up till now. So people describe an in-labor non-emergency cesarean, which is when, you know, you're in one of those categories where you do need to have a cesarean. For example, you know, your baby's in a breech position and there isn't a care provider that can offer you a vaginal breech. So the ideal really from a hormonal perspective is to allow labor to start on its own, which means that the mother's readiness and the baby's readiness are present. You know, all those preparations that we've talked about, some of which we know and some of which we don't really understand in humans, but we know happen in animals, like the brain maturation of the pleasure and reward centers, for example. So, you know, if the physiological onset of term labor, I'm not talking about premature labor here, has happened, then we know that mother and baby are ready. And particularly we know that the baby's lungs are mature. And that's really important because even, you know, even a baby that's 40 weeks born by a pre-labor cesarean, you know, can have some breathing difficulties because they're not totally ready because they haven't gone into labor. So as I said, that's the biggest hormonal gap. So if we wanted to address that hormonal gap, we would actually allow labor to start naturally and then we'd do the cesarean if it's needed, for example, for a breech baby. I mean, it's obviously more difficult to organize in terms of hospitals because you're doing a lot of cesareans outside of hours. But, you know, the upside, and there are some studies showing this, is that the baby's coming come out in better condition. You know, one study showed less respiratory difficulties for babies when they were born by an in-labor, non-emergency cesarean is the phrase that's been used. So that's one way of closing the hormonal gaps. And if we were really concerned about it, I think, you know, we'd be putting more resources into that type of cesarean.
In the first episode of this podcast, Dr. Darshan Narvaez and I briefly touched upon birth. So in addition to cesareans, epidurals and induction, we also mentioned augmentation instruments, episiotomies, antibiotics, managed third stage, continuous monitoring, restriction of movement and medical pain relief, and how, you know, it is extremely unlikely that a birth in a hospital will occur without at least one of these disturbances to the physiological process. I feel that in our Western society, these less significant interventions are seen as really no big deal. But you know, what long-term hormonal effects do these have? And is there anything that can be done afterwards?
Well, I guess the thing is to say that the long-term hormonal effects of any interventions are really not well studied. Sometimes I do a talk on the long-term, the impact of birth on lifelong well-being. And, you know, it may be a little bit better these days, but in 2012, someone did a big review and looked at all the studies that have followed children up and found that there was like 40 studies of big high-quality studies that followed children up after birth to look at the impacts of interventions during pregnancy or labor and birth. And they weren't generally birth interventions. When we have, you know, because of the increasing interest in the microbiome, you know, the gut flora that the baby gets from the mother at birth, and we know that there's a big microbiome gap there, and when the baby's born by cesarean, the baby doesn't get that natural transfer of the mother's gut flora into the baby's gut. So there has been more interest in the long-term impacts of cesarean from that point of view, and then looking, could that cause other diseases in the long term? And there certainly are increased susceptibilities that babies born by cesarean have because of that microbiome gap. But as far as hormonal gaps, we really don't have information about that. But the other interventions that you're talking about, actually, when I wrote the report, working with Childbirth Connection in the US, we actually started off with a long list of interventions, like, as you say, you know, position in labor, caregiver in labor, eating and drinking in labor, a whole lot of things. And we wanted to see what was the impact of those types of care on the hormones, and there just wasn't enough research. So the whole area is very under-researched. And, you know, when you think about that as a birthing mama or birthing family, it's really quite shocking that we're doing all these things to mothers and babies and we don't actually know what the long-term effects are. We know that, you know, there's a model of understanding the impact of early experiences on offspring, and it's called Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, or DOHAD, or Fetal Origins of Disease, sometimes also called. You know, we know, you know, this is from some groundbreaking studies done that linked babies of low birth weight born in the 100 years ago with subsequently having increased risk of heart disease later in life. And then the field has really opened up. And, you know, when you hear on the radio, I'm just making this up, but, you know, study the when a mother has more than 3 cups of coffee a day, the baby's more likely to have high blood pressure. That's not true, by the way, but you hear those kind of things day to day, right? And because we have this in our culture that what happens in pregnancy can affect lifelong health and well-being. But we haven't actually, apart from the microbiome idea, we haven't really thought what happens in labor and birth could change lifelong health and well-being. And from my perspective, I think it really could. I think it does kind of imprint in some way hormonal systems for mothers and babies, but we don't really have a lot of research on that at the moment. And we do know, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we understand this is true for pregnancy effects. We also understand from animal research that it's also true for, and increasing human research, it's also true postpartum as well. So there were some interesting animal studies where they looked at the degree of maternal care that offspring got. And what they did was they got two types of rats that were genetically bred to give high levels of maternal care or low levels of maternal care. And then they cross-fostered the babies. So the babies that were bred to have to give low levels of maternal care were looked after by high maternal caring mothers. And then those females who'd got high levels of maternal care but were bred to give low levels themselves, when they went on to have babies, they gave high levels. So it seemed that it wasn't actually a genetic thing, it was actually a behavioral thing. How they were treated actually changed, epigenetically changed their oxytocin systems. It that they went on to give high levels of maternal care. And that's kind of a groundbreaking study that we could apply to all mammals. We could apply that to humans as well. If the babies are given high levels of maternal care, does that give, oh, by the way, those offspring were also less stressed as adults, had better health and well-being. So is that true for human babies as well? You know, we're kind of increasingly getting some kind of evidence that that's true. So, you know, if we say what happens in pregnancy has lifelong effects, what happens after in the postpartum period has lifelong effects, then it'd be a bit strange to think that what happened in birth didn't have lifelong effects. And also from my point of view, not just that, but birth, you know, sets up this interaction of pleasure and reward between the mother and the baby. That's what I think is really critical. It means that the baby starts off as a source of pleasure and reward for the mother, and that just kind of keeps going. That pleasure and reward keeps going. It's reinforced with, you know, with body contact. It gets reinforced with caretaking behaviors. It gets reinforced with breastfeeding. And if the mother misses that kind of big activation of the pleasure and reward centers, then that could have long-term impact. She could be less rewarded for her baby. Mothering could be much less pleasurable. She could, you know, have a different attitude to her baby. And in fact, that has been shown when women who have epidurals. So these were studies that looked at women had epidurals versus not. And they found that when women had an epidural and they missed out on all this activation of the oxytocin system in the brain that switches on the pleasure and reward centers that we're talking about, first of all, in hospitals, they had their babies in the nursery more than with them in comparison to women who hadn't had this. And that was actually in proportion to how much of the drugs they'd received. I can talk about the mechanism if you're interested. But and then at 1 month, they described their babies as less adaptable, more intense and more bothersome. And obviously there's no drugs in the mother or in the baby at 1 month. But from the hormonal perspective, I interpret that as meaning that the mother just hasn't had this activation of the pleasure and reward centers in relation to her baby, and her baby isn't as rewarding to her. And that's what we saw also in that study I quoted of the brain study of mothers who'd had, it was actually an MRI study of mothers who'd had a cesarean versus physiological birth and the activation of the pleasure and reward centers in relation to her baby. So I think that's a really critical outcome of physiological labor and birth, is this incredible pleasure and reward, or ecstasy as I call it. If you go to my website, you can download an ebook called Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor. It's designed to turn on our pleasure and reward centers to make us feel good. Obviously it's good, but the main purpose of it is to, you know, imprint pleasure and reward in relation to our baby, so that we will take this, you know, very extreme type of care that mammalian babies need. And, you know, it's a really big job looking after a baby for any mammalian mama, you know, and this is a system that has us rewarded and motivated to do it, and that ensures the survival of the species. So that's one of the really important hormonal gaps, I think, that happens with, you know, several of these interventions that we're talking about, especially epidurals, especially pre-labor cesarean.
Okay, so then can you tell us the difference, I guess, in the impact of having birth at home with a midwife or at a hospital with an obstetrician?
Well, I guess the difference is the chance of having a physiological birth, because, you know, in most home birth studies, the chance of having those interventions, well, some of them you can't get at home, obviously, like an epidural, or generally you can't get, you know, opiate pain relief like pethidine, meperidine. Obviously, you can't have a cesarean. So even though obviously some women start at home and end up with the cesarean, the chance of that is generally between 5 and 10% for most home birth studies. Whereas if you go to hospital, your chance in, countries like Australia and US and UK is somewhere between 25 and 35%. And in some countries, it's even 40 or 50%. So the chance of interventions is much, much lower. And the reason for that is because, you know, at home, you're basically in a situation where you feel private, safe and unobserved, and that's the basic requirements for birth in all mammals. Just going back to our evolutionary model, you know, and any animal giving birth in the wild needs to know that they're in the safest place possible, that there's no danger, there's no threat. And a labouring female is often very sensitive to those things in her environment. You know, she'll be looking around for any strange, you know, shapes, smells, unfamiliar individuals around her would raise the stress in her body, and that could that could raise her stress hormones, which counteracts the processes of labor and birth. You're really to ensure that the laboring female is in the safest place possible. And the trouble is, when we go to, you know, go to hospital to have our babies, we may have an intellectual idea that this is a safe place, but our body systems, our primitive brain, our limbic system has another idea. We're going into this place that has strange smells, strange noises. We're attended generally by people that we don't have a close relationship with. So all of those things feed into the limbic system and the sense of threat at this very basic, you know, animalistic primitive brain level, and all of those things can switch off labor. Many women, listeners may have had the experience of labor's going really well at home, you know, they're getting quite into it, and then they move to hospital and everything shuts down because of that change in environment, because of the primitive settings in our brain. It's hardwired into us. And, you know, the way to overcome that, you could say there's a hormonal gap there, and the way to overcome that is to be in a situation that you feel is private, safe, and unobserved as possible. So home is obviously, for most people, a place like that, and having a care provider that you know, that you have known through your pregnancy. I mean, this is, you know, what we've done through thousands or maybe millions of years in terms of looking after laboring women. It's always been someone, they've been cared for by someone they know, whether it's a member of their family, a granny midwife, a member of their community. I mean, you know, and the woman's emotional well-being in labor has been the number one priority, and that's for very good physiological reasons. But, you know, we've kind of moved birth from home, you know, with familiar people into hospital with unfamiliar people, and we haven't taken on board the importance of women's emotional well-being in labor. We've put it down the bottom of the list, and from my point of view, that causes big hormonal gaps. That means that women are at risk of activation of the stress system through the environment that they're in, and that's going to counteract all of the hormonal things that we've been talking about. It's going to switch off oxytocin. It's going to increase their stress system, adrenaline and noradrenaline. You know, I say it's like a saber-toothed tiger in the room, even though saber-toothed tigers are extinct, right? That's how our bodies see it. So, you know, we're not really supporting, you know, labor in hospital with an obstetrician is not really supporting the most basic needs of the laboring woman, as Michelle Odont would call it.
To follow on from that, how is the mother's mental state affected by the intensity of that hormonal cocktail in this, you know, in this primal moment?
Yeah, so lots of ways, because these hormones are or neurochemicals are produced in the brain. So oxytocin, just going back to some basic things about hormones, a hormone is a substance made in one part of the body with effects in another part. And in labor and birth, oxytocin is actually made inside the brain. It comes out, it has effects. It is released inside the brain. It has all these effects we've been talking about of switching on the pleasure and reward centers. It also has its own natural pain relieving effect. So the more intense labor gets, the stronger the contractions, the more the oxytocin released into the body to cause the contractions, the more is released into the brain to help with the pain of those contractions. So it's a very nice system, yeah? And we also get high levels of endorphins in the brain during labor and birth, and they help the mother to deal with the stress and pain of labor. And this is all mammalian mothers I'm talking about. And they also put us into this like altered state of consciousness, as I call it. And one of the Native American groups apparently says that the laboring woman goes out to the stars to collect the soul of her baby and bring it back. So that's what happens. We go into this altered state, and for some women it can completely abolish the pain of labor, for many of us it doesn't, but it puts us into this altered state where we can kind of transcend the stress and pain, just becomes one part of the process. We're in this altered state, you know, and all of that feeds into pleasure and reward center activation. So, you know, the intensity of labor and birth is being helped by all of these hormones. And then at that moment of birth, you know, the contractions stop, the external intensity, the bodily intensity stops, and then the mother's flooded with all these reward and pleasure centers as she meets her baby for the first time. So that's why I say that ecstatic birth is nature's hormonal blueprint. That's how it's designed to work.
A few episodes ago, I spoke with Alexa, and she talked about how during the birth of her first child, once the head was out, she immediately checked for a cord around her daughter's neck. It was wrapped tightly around, and she was unable to loosen it, and her response was to consciously push the rest of her baby out, which she did. And then during my first birth, after my son's head came out, my immediate thought was, if the rest of the body doesn't come out in the next two pushes, I'll check for a nuchal cord. If there's no cord, then I'll change into this position in case it's shoulder dystocia. But so in these mammalian moments, how do we still have the clarity to think so rationally and calmly?
Yeah, well, two things. I mean, one thing is that these hormones take us deeply inside our bodies. So we're responding, you know, we're moving, we're, you know, women in labor can get into these really weird positions, but it turns out to be exactly the position that helps their baby come out because, you know, labor and birth in humans is quite an asymmetrical process. Like in other mammals, the baby just comes straight out through the birth canal, but we have these twists and turns. So, you know, sometimes you need to move and move in particular ways or lift a leg up or something. And you know, these hormones help us to go into our bodies, you know, to not be distracted by external things and then get the messages from our babies and from our bodies. I think that's one aspect of it. I think that also the other thing that happens is at that, there's a switch in hormones that happens at the pushing stage. You know, we have the stage that we call transition where the mother's been, the cervix has been dilating, getting bigger and bigger and bigger to be ready for the baby to come out. And then there's a switch that happens and we actually call it the second stage of labor. We call it a different name, the pushing stage of labor. And what there is actually a hormonal transition as well. So what we think happens, and this is something I'm really interested in studying in my PhD actually, but what we think happens is there's a surge of adrenaline and noradrenaline, these activating, these fight or flight hormones naturally kick in, and they these extremely high levels actually encourage contractions. They augment and make stronger the contractions that are happening so that the baby births, mother births her baby quickly and easily, but it also gives the mother the strength. So this in this transition, when the mother get this full, what we call fetus ejection reflex, and it's something Michelle Odonce talked about quite a lot. You know, the mother will suddenly have this burst of adrenaline and she'll be wide-eyed and upright and have this strong thing and push her baby out. And that's actually, those are very much alertness activating hormones in the brain as well. So noradrenaline in the brain, suddenly women can describe suddenly being very clear mentally because of the surge of adrenaline and noradrenaline in their body. So there is a shift, and what you're describing could also be part of that shift. Really, the mother gets a lot more kind of the brain gets sharper, you could say, compared to earlier in labor.
Could you, so you've just mentioned the second stage, could you tell us more about the physiological third stage of birth in a hormonally optimal environment? What would be happening at this point?
So the third stage of labor, we're talking about between when the baby comes out and when the placenta comes out. And we could even extend that and say the first hour after birth, because that includes that time. So this is actually a really critical time for mother and baby. It's the time that the mother's most likely to die from a hemorrhage. It's the time the baby's most likely to die as well. So it's a critical time in terms of reproductive success. So there's a lot of inbuilt systems to support the mother and support the baby. And what happens is that the baby comes out, the baby's had a surge of these activating hormones, adrenaline, noradrenaline, even higher than the mother. And that helps the baby to deal with the stresses of labor and also helps to clear the baby's lungs, make the baby ready for life outside the womb. So the baby's in this ideal hormonal state for a successful transition in that first hour after birth. The baby's, I don't want to get too complicated here, so just stop me if I'm not explaining this well. I usually do this with diagrams and things, but basically the other important thing for the baby is that the baby has a good supply of blood, has all the blood that the baby needs to make this transition. And all the blood that the baby needs is actually more of higher blood volume than is in the baby's body during pregnancy. So during pregnancy, the baby is in what I describe as hotel of the womb. And the mother's body and the placenta is doing all these things for the baby, like keeping the baby warm, like delivering the baby nourishment, taking away the baby's waste, metabolizing toxins for the baby. And then once the baby comes out, they've got to perform all those functions for themselves, which is basically the functions of the skin, which is heat exchange, the lungs, which is breathing, the gut, which is nourishment, the kidney, which is excretion, and the liver, which is metabolizing toxins or just breaking down chemicals. So in the womb, in the hotel of the womb, all of those functions, the baby's not performing itself. They're all being done by the mother via the placenta. But once the baby comes out, they've got to do all those things for themselves. So all those organ systems that aren't really working in the womb have to suddenly kick in and work. And to do that, all these organ systems need extra blood. They need a delivery of blood to activate them and get them moving. So the baby needs this extra blood, in inverted commas, after birth compared to before birth inside the baby's body. And the baby actually gets that from this thing that we call the placental transfusion. So as the baby comes out, there's still the cords, if the cord's still intact, which is obviously what happens in evolutionary terms, yeah. As my friend Sarah Wickham said, if we were designed to cut the cord, we'd be born with a cord clamp on our thigh, right? So the baby's outside and the placenta's still inside. And the mother's uterus is squeezing the placenta and actually pushing blood to the baby each time the placenta is squeezed. It pushes blood through these open vessels in the cord to the baby. And then the uterus relaxes, and even sometimes some blood can go back to the mother. But overall, the baby gets this extra blood that it needs for all this placenta to perfuse all these newly functioning organs through this process of placental transfusion. And it takes 3 to 5 minutes, something like that. Lots of things can influence it. But basically, the thing that's going to influence the most is if the cord's cut straight away. So we have been really hampering the baby's adaptation outside the womb by immediate cord clamping. And thankfully, you know, since I've been involved in this area about 20 years, that's really going out of style. And delayed cord clamping, so-called delayed cord clamping, has been happening because we know that that extra blood benefits the baby in lots of ways, including giving the baby the extra iron that's in that placental transfusion and makes the baby, the child, less likely to be anemic. Actually gives better development, neurodevelopment at age 4 when babies have a delay and get the, more of this placental transfusion. So that's a really important part of the baby's transition, the physiological, the surge of adrenaline and noradrenaline that we call the catecholamine surge that helps the baby make a successful transition, especially a breathing transition, and then the placental transfusion are really important for a successful transition for the baby. And then for the mother, as I say in my workshops, I say the mother's had 9 months to get fully pregnant. Within a few minutes, she's not pregnant anymore. So it's massive transition for the mother as well. And she's had this placenta that's been stuck on the inside of her uterus, giving huge amounts of blood to the baby, and suddenly that all stops. So she has to seal up those placental blood vessels so that she doesn't bleed from when the placenta peels away. So for the mother, it's really, really important that her uterus contracts quickly to seal off those placental vessels. And that means oxytocin. That means, again, feeling private, safe and unobserved so that she's not getting these stress hormones counteracting the contractions and the oxytocin. And it also means that she has skin-to-skin contact with her baby because that releases oxytocin as well. And, you know, basically that first hour, she's still really sensitive. Her oxytocin system is still really sensitive. So even the baby's early, and when the baby's, I don't know if anyone of your listeners have seen the breast crawl, I recommend you search it. There's lots of nice videos. So, you know, again, our evolutionary imprint is the baby goes on the belly, the baby crawls up. As it steps, it's got the stepping reflex that actually naturally massages the uterus and helps the uterus to contract. The baby locates the nipple because it smells like amniotic fluid. And then the baby starts to massage the mother's nipple. And then after a while, sometimes even half an hour, the baby actually begins to suckle. And all of those things that the baby does actually benefit the mother's transition as well. And even those early massaging behaviors can increase the mother's oxytocin even 10 times to what it was at birth. So these big increases in oxytocin is what helps the mother to make a safe, you know, life, to save her life, to give these nice strong contractions that prevent postpartum hemorrhage, as we call it. So that's what's really important for the mother as well.
So I have been fortunate to experience 2 completely undisturbed, hormonally optimal births. I also ran marathons in the past, and that feeling of crossing the finishing line of a marathon is the closest, though still considerably inferior, comparison I can make to that euphoric feeling I still get whenever I think of their births. So giving birth just made me feel more powerful than I have ever been. And I was also told that in New Zealand, 2 midwives are required to attend a home birth because once the baby is born, there are 2 patients. So they need a midwife there for each patient. And knowing how powerful and euphoric I felt, the idea of being treated like a patient when neither the baby nor myself are sick or injured is perplexing. Can you tell me more about this cocktail of hormones that make me feel so strong and powerful? And you've just mentioned that the first hour of after birth is critical for both the mother and the baby. So are we really patients at this time? And so what are the, how does that affect us?
Well, it's really everything that I've said about the activation of the pleasure and reward centers. That's what generates this euphoria, this ecstasy. You know, it's designed to be a positive experience for all mammalian mothers. So that's really important part of what I call Mother Nature's superb design. And as I mentioned also, you know, that time after birth, the mother is still in labor. She's still sensitive to her environment. You know, she needs to feel private, safe and unobserved. So that's critical. And, you know, sometimes when I describe these hormones, I say it's like the best runner's high we'll ever get, which is exactly what you're describing as well. And it is a natural physiological process. I mean, I'm also a medically trained doctor, so I know that sometimes things can go wrong, and I know sometimes things can go wrong for the mother and for the baby. So having two caregivers there from a medical perspective is quite reasonable. You don't want to be one caregiver in that situation when something goes wrong, and something does go wrong occasionally, you know, in even just in the most low-risk situation, you know, about 2 to 4 babies per 1,000 will die. So, you know, it's we're superbly designed for it, but there are things go wrong, just like in our own health and well-being. We're perfectly designed to breathe, but sometimes people get asthma. So it's really, you know, the balance, as you say, between making backup plans and having, you know, that when it's needed versus not disturbing women. And personally, I don't think those things are incompatible if we think from the perspective of the woman's experience, because you could have 2 midwives at your home birth and they could be in the next room, you know. Like when I had my babies at home, sometimes there were 2 care providers there, but they were in the next room writing up the notes and they didn't disturb us at all. So there's ways of making it work, you know, whatever the circumstances are, but we've got to think from private, safe and unobserved, you know. And you know, and I think, and personally I think the ideal situation is, and you know, that the woman has the choices about who she has there and where they are and how involved they are. And you know, she can say to them, look, I'm happy for you to be here if that's what's necessary, but can you be in this room and I'll let you know if I need you. And I think that's an ideal setup.
Perfect. Yeah, I do like the idea of that. I was going to next ask you about breastfeeding, bed sharing, unless you think there's anything more that needed to be added.
Yeah, so I mean, these, you know, ecstatic hormones, as I call them, the pleasure and reward activation, is really designed to continue right through mothering as we, you know, because again, for humans and other mammals, there's this long period of dependency, you know, when the young can't look after themselves and need protection. So these caretaking hormones, which involves the activation of the pleasure and reward centers, keeps going through that dependent period, which is very long for humans, you might have noticed. So, you know, when my belief is when we get it fully activated at labor and birth, then it continues on, and it's very helpful in the teenage years that you have a basically positive, you know, experience and that kind of brain firing, wiring your child with your pleasure and reward centers. So the things that we do that encourage it, as I said, breastfeeding, you know, there's no, from my point of view, there's no limit to how long you can breastfeed for, as long as you're happy and the child's happy. You know, every time you breastfeed, you're not only, you're getting this pleasure and reward download. And the reason is because the breastfeeding is good for the child as well. You know, not only does the child get nutrients from the breast milk, but they also get, especially as you get towards weaning, you know, the less amount of milk you have, the more immune factors there are in that milk to help the child to deal with the external world that they're encountering. So, you know, it's all the system of, you know, encouraging you to do the things that are going to help your baby to survive, which is breastfeeding, which is being close to your baby, which is sleeping with your baby. So all of these things that we're talking about happen during the night as well. You know, the closeness with your baby stimulates those pleasure and reward centers, keeps you, you know, happy to be with your baby, wants you to, you know, it keeps you wanting to be with your baby. And that is a natural instinct. We want to pick up our babies. We want to be with our babies. It feels good to be with our babies, because that's why we're still all here today. That's why humans have survived, because we've kept our babies close. So, you know, sometimes we call breastfeeding, you know, birth, breastfeeding and attachment 3 separate systems, but it's actually all one system of reproductive success. And it keeps on going as long as we need that, and as long as our babies or our young are dependent and need that help. So sometimes people say, you know, how long should children co-sleep for? And I say, well, until they could defend themselves against a predator at night, because that's what we're hardwired to do, you know. So, yeah, anyway, but all those things are obviously when your children are older or whatever, they're negotiable. You know, this is the evolutionary blueprint I'm talking about, and those things can be negotiated. You know, you can work out creative solutions in your household, you know, like
lying down with your baby to sleep, for example, you know, when the child needs the most, you know, reassurance and support. That could be a solution, or having your baby in a bed in your room. You know, there's lots and lots of ways of dealing with this. But really, you know, like birth, we've got to come from what is our evolutionary, what is our hormonal blueprint.
Perfect. Okay, Sarah, I will put links in the show notes to your website, your Facebook page, your book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering, your report on the hormonal physiology of childbearing. And oh, you also mentioned your PDF on ecstatic birth.
Yeah. So that's one of those things that comes as a pop-up when people go to my website. So just say go to my website and subscribe and get my ecstatic birth PDF.
Excellent. Is there anything else there that I've missed?
No, that's all brilliant. That's great. Thank you.
Perfect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sign up to my newsletter. Yes, you can get my ecstatic book and sign up to my newsletter.
Yeah, Dr. Sarah Buckley, wow, what a privilege it has been talking to one of my favourite birth advocates today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. Do you have any final words of wisdom to leave us with?
Yeah, thank you, Emily. It's been a pleasure. Well, really, it's about, you know, trusting your body. We've got these millions of years of, you know, evolutionary wisdom encoded in our bodies, and our bodies are superbly designed for pregnancy, for labour and birth, for mothering as well. So trust your body and trust your baby. Your baby also has those millions of years of hardwiring, and your baby knows what they need. So trust your body, trust your baby, and enjoy the ride.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.